Today we're breaking the first rule of Fight Club. We're decoding the cult classic film through the lens of conspiracy, occult symbolism, and hidden programming. Was Fight Club secretly about MKUltra mind control? We'll unpack the initiation rituals of death and rebirth, Freemasonry's order out of chaos, the strange symbolism of soap, and even ties to 9/11 predictive programming. Plus, we'll dive into Gnosticism, consumerism, and how this film shaped today's red pill alpha bro culture. You'll never be the same after listening to today's deep dive into one of the most greatest films of all time. I am Jax Paranoia. You're listening to Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture. Now today we're beginning our decode of the cult classic film Fight Club. We're going to go through the entire film and point out the symbolism of MKUltra mind control, programming, alter egos, Freemasonry, the ritual initiation of death and rebirth, the true meaning of soap, order out of chaos, human sacrifice, the reconciliation of opposing polarities, that's right, go with the Bobs, know thyself, integrating the shadow, nihilism, Project Mayhem, red pill alpha bro masculinity, Gnosticism, consumerism, and 9/11 predictive programming. Now, this is a massive subject because this film is very long and it's very dense and it's full of all kinds of crazy stuff, right? As crazy as this crazy studio of mine, I can't stand it, okay? One of these days, we're going to get a proper functioning studio. Quick shout out to all my supporters out there. Patreon, VIP section, Apple, you guys make this happen every month. And someday you're going to provide me a great studio with functioning mic booms and all this stuff. Now, this is a two-part series because it's way too much to do in one episode. I know, you're probably thinking, Isaac, it's just Fight Club. Well, you'd be surprised at how much Illuminate confirmedness we've got to deal with because I read the book, I watched the movie, I've seen the movie countless times. It's one of my favorite movies, all right? So we've got a lot to get through, so let's go through my regular rigmarole of what you come here to expect. Should you watch Fight Club? Absolutely. If you haven't seen it, it's easily one of the greatest films of all time. A top 10 film for me. That's right. Top 10 film of all time. Here's the caveat. How long is it? Pretty damn long. It cruises through 139 minutes. It's almost 2.5 hours. When you watch it, you're going to be surprised at how fast that 2.5 hours goes, though, because really great job with it. Who's in it? Well, you know, all-star cast. You already know who's in it. We're going to keep it brief, though, because I've got a lot to get through with the film itself. So we're not going to spend too much time glazing our favorite actors in here. Edward Norton plays an unnamed character. We're going to call him narrator, because that's basically all you get. He is narrator. And this is probably my favorite Edward Norton film. Second favorite, Spike Lee's 25th Hour, if you haven't seen it. Absolute phenomenal movie. Not really my speed, typically, but it's a great movie. Josie loves Painted Veil, but, you know, he's also in Rounders. That was great. He was in American History X. That was great. And now I haven't seen Primal Fear, which is probably borderline criminal. That was his first breakout role. Now, interestingly enough, he did an episode of Finding Your Roots and found out that he was related to Pocahontas, not Elizabeth Warren, but Pocahontas and Julia Roberts. So is he a Nepo baby? I mean, kind of, I guess, sort of. Brad Pitt plays Tyler Durden. And again, this is my favorite Brad Pitt movie, Fight Club, you know. Tough second place for him as well. I loved Babylon. I loved Interview with a Vampire, 7, 12 Monkeys. We did a whole analysis on 12 Monkeys. He had appearances in the classics from the 80s, Growing Pains and Freddy's Nightmares. I believe he was in the first episode, if I'm not mistaken. I was actually watching it one day. It showed up on, man, where was it? Anyway, and I was like, is that Brad Pitt? Yeah, Brad Pitt's in it. Lots of great films. Josie loves A River Runs Through It and Legends of the Fall. Those aren't my speed, but they're good movies nonetheless. Now, Brad Pitt, of course, slaying the ladies. He was with Jennifer Aniston and Angelina Jolie. I don't need to tell you about how handsome he is. But a peak Brad Pitt physique in this movie, by the way. Also, he seemed to have a very normal upbringing. No strong Nepo baby links to Hollywood, as far as I could tell. Now let's talk about, you know, we're going to keep it very hetero here. in the most homosexual way possible. He was very ripped in this movie. Like, I remember when I watched this movie when it came out, I was like, dude, I want to look like Brad Pitt. What's this guy on? He was 5'11 and 160 pounds for this role, which is absurdly lean, in my opinion. You know, for comparison purposes, Edward Norton was actually roughly the same size. He was about the same height, about the same weight, but he looked far less ripped. He almost looks frail. He almost looks sickly, which was by design, because in the movie, in the story, he's the soy boy and Brad is the bad boy that he always wanted to be. Now, ironically, just 1 year prior to this movie, Edward Norton was in American History X, and he was 200 pounds. So he had something like 40 pounds of muscle. He would have whooped Tyler Durden's ass any day of the week, by the way. But because I'm always real intrigued by the physiques of dudes that look ripped, and I'm like, bro, I want to look like that. If you want to look like Brad Pitt in Fight Club, I got bad news. No more cookies. It's only chicken breast and broccoli for about 4 months, and you'll get there. But, dude, my man looks shredded, dude. Absolutely ridiculous. Now, he apparently also consented to removing bits of his front teeth for the role to look, you know, more like a street fighter. Helena Bonham Carter plays Marla Singer. Meatloaf plays Bob with the bitch tits. Also explicit language on this episode because it's in the movie clips, so I'm doing it, right? So you've been forewarned. For all my people riding around with their kids, maybe this isn't the one for you, right? Not today. But this is a AirPods episode. Jared Leto, he's in this movie too. Very small role. He is, of course, a cult leader now, today. So, which is ironic because in Fight Club, it's very much about a secret society cult. Also, strangely enough, in the movie, in the scene where there's a scene where Brad Pitt is talking about the rules of Fight Club and he looks over at Jared Leto, and this is in 90, you know, filmed in 98, I guess, released in October 99. And he looks over at Jared Leto and talks about people being celebrities and millionaires and musicians and stuff, and like that turns out that's what Jared Leto was going to become, you know, because Jared Leto was not uber famous yet. I believe Requiem for a Dream came out in 2000, and that was the movie where I think people discovered Jared Leto. Myself, I only figured out who he was then. The director, David Fincher, another legend in directing. He directed Seven, The Game, which I also did an episode about. Which, by the way, if you are looking for an index of all the episodes, you can find it. I post a link to every single episode after I release it on IlluminatiWatcher.com. Now, if you're looking for that link specifically, go to allmylinks.com/IsaacW, two A's for double awesome. And you'll find links to everything I always talk about, my index of every episode, my merchandise, my other podcasts, all that stuff, okay? And you can find on the index The Game episode I did, I think it was in 2020, all right? Fincher also did Benjamin Button with Brad Pitt. He did Mindhunter, a bunch of music videos. He started out music videos, Madonna, Michael Jackson, Aerosmith, The Outfield, great stuff. Now, the movie is based off the book by Chuck Palahniuk. I should have looked up how to say his name, but I didn't. I'm sorry. I did read his book, though. I bought his book and read it, so that counts for something. I had watched Fight Club when it came out, was obsessed with it. I was like, dude, this is a phenomenal movie. And I actually bought Chuck Palahniuk's second book, or a book after this called Choke, and read that. And then I watched Choke the movie, and it was okay. The book was better. But as far as the book version of Fight Club and the movie version of Fight Club, I mean, the book is much more revealing of some of the occult connections to be had here. So I'm going to point out some various book passages as we go through the film. But in all reality, the film's just as good as the book. So for what it's worth, usually it's not the case. Usually it's like, oh, the book's clearly better than the movie. Not here. I think the movie's just as good as the book. Okay, so without further ado, this is going to be plot spoiler territory. You've been forewarned. Like I said, one of the greatest films of all time. I would highly recommend you watch the movie before listening to this, because there's an element of sort of surprise and mystery to unpack as you go through the movie that makes it worth watching before you listen to this. So if you're ready, let's go. All right. We start out. We get the credits, opening credit sequence, which is a bunch of neurons firing in a brain. Makes me think about my beloved Twin Peaks when Dale Cooper talks about dreams forming when acetylcholine neurons fire high voltage impulses into the forebrain. That's kind of what we're seeing in the opening credits, strangely enough. It's also showing us what these corporations are analyzing inside the minds of the consumer, right? Your Edward Bernaysian propaganda, trying to get into the mind of the consumer to brainwash us through mind control, MK Ultra. These are the things studying how the mind works. So it all kinds of makes sense, right? Because that's also an element of the story is MK Ultra dissociative identity disorders. Now we go through the credits, and immediately we see Brad Pitt, Tyler Durden, putting a gun into the mouth of Edward Norton, the narrator, and they're talking about explosives in this giant building. I mean, you jump right into the deep end. You're like, what? This is actually the ending of the movie. They're showing us first, a la Pulp Fiction, and it's a major clue. Now, if you go to the book, the way the book starts, it tells you a major clue right off the bat. It says, I'm going to read you from the book. Tyler gets me a job as a waiter. After that, Tyler's pushing a gun in my mouth and saying, the first step to eternal life is you have to die. For a long time, though, Tyler and I were best friends. People are always asking, did I know about Tyler Durden? So literally right off the bat, you've got the death and rebirth ritual. All right. It's the crux of all secret society initiations and rituals. It's the alchemical process. Also, it's the destruction of primordial matter. It's the negredo. It's whatever you want to call it. It's about stripping the ego and being rebuilt from the base, which is something that happens throughout this whole movie. And we're going to unpack that in part two in the conclusion about all the examples of how this happens and what this means. All right. So the film, it cuts to Bob at the men's support group played by Meatloaf, which, again, also makes me think about my beloved Twin Peaks and Bob. And I promise you right now, for all you people out there rolling your eyes at the Twin Peaks references, I'm not going to bring up Twin Peaks again in this whole analysis. This was only two examples. All right. So you're probably thinking, what's the connection here? Is David Fincher a Twin Peaks fan? Probably is. All the cool people and all the great artists always are. And I don't know, I didn't see any confirmation of that from David Fincher, but I did see that his sister, Emily, sorry, I'm trying to look at, I bought a teleprompter for my studio, and I got a crazy glare. Looks like Emily Fincher. Emily Fincher was actually in Twin Peaks in season two. That's right. She was the Louise, the flashlight dancing babysitter from season two. You know the scene. If you're a Twin Peaks fan, you already know what I'm talking about. And she actually worked with Lynch and Frost on a show they did called On the Air. Isn't that something? Are there all these Twin Peaks references baked in from David Fincher? I propose it to be so. All right, no more Twin Peaks talk again today, just for this episode. So the narrator, he's at work. He says everything's a copy of a copy of a copy. He critiques how corporations are going to end up owning all the planets, like Planet Starbucks. And then he talks about the dreaded day job, noting the behaviors of his supervisor and bowel movements of his coworkers. And then he's at the condo talking about the capitalist drive to buy IKEA items for his place. Very, very, for people who aren't aware, I'm cusp of Gen X and millennial culture, so I kind of understand both generations. This is a very Gen X type cynical rant, right? Gen X is very snarky, very cynical, very nihilistic in a sense, is kind of how you would frame that. And that's very much the vibe of this whole movie. Then we get to the narrator going to the doctor's office where he's saying how he can't sleep. The doctor recommends he goes to some, you know, chew some valerian root and get more exercise. And also to try men's support groups, which leads us more into the proper story. Because this opening scene is just chaos. Boom, boom, boom. What is happening? Who are these people, right? You also get a subliminal shot of Tyler in that doctor scene. Now, this first actual proper scene is interesting. Because you'll notice at least two of the men in this men's support group will later be seen in the Project Mayhem group, which we'll cover, if you recall. And the leader of the group, of the men's support group in this very opening scene, says, "I look around this room and I see a lot of courage," which you'll also hear later when Tyler says, "I look around this room and I see a lot of people," which means you're breaking the first rule of Fight Club. I propose, well, we don't need to get into it, but I think that this is all connected. All right. Now, after the meeting, there's a little post-meeting hug sesh, and narrator and Bob embrace, and there's crying, and narrator starts tearing up, and he says, "Losing all hope is freedom." And now, guess what? He can sleep. Unfortunately, now he's also addicted to going to these support group meetings, okay? So he's at a meeting, and they're talking about going through a green door, the heart chakra, and all these visualization exercises. And I want you to take a listen to this clip. Also, quick plug, if you're on the Patreon or VIP section, you can watch the video version of the show by going to Tier 2, all right? Tier 2 is what gets you the video version of the show, early access, ad-free, the whole works. Because I've been putting a lot of effort into these videos. I got this teleprompter so I can look into your beautiful eyes, into your soul as I speak to you. And I'm going to play clips from the movie. If you're on the free feed loser status, you'll notice sometimes I can't upload these videos to YouTube and Rumble and all that stuff because there's all these weird issues that they have. We'll just leave it at that. So you don't get all my videos. And, of course, you get them late. Of course, you get them with the ads. Oh, so annoying, isn't it? You may or may not even see this video on YouTube. It depends, because what I'll do is I'll make the video for my Tier 2 folks, upload it to an unlisted Rumble channel, and when I upload it to YouTube, it'll give me all kinds of warnings and copyrights and all this crazy stuff, and generally, especially with the movie clips, I'll either have to cut them out of the video you see, or, you know, I can't do it, or they'll put an excessive amount of ads on it because it's someone else's content. It's a whole nightmare. So support your favorite show. Go Tier 2. Here's the clip.
"Now we're going to open the green door, the heart chakra.
I wasn't really dying. I wasn't host to cancer or parasites. I was the warm little center that the life of this world crowded around.
Imagine your pain as a white ball of healing light. Moves over your body, healing you. Now keep this going. Remember to breathe and step forward through the back door of the room. Where does it lead? To your cave. Step forward into your cave. That's right. You're going deeper into your cave. You're going to find your power animal.
Slide." "Every evening I died, and every evening I was born again, resurrected. Bob loved me because he thought my testicles were removed too. Being there, pressed against his tits, ready to cry. This was my vacation. And she ruined everything."
"This is cancer, right?"
All right, so narrator does the exercise, the visualization. It takes him through the back door of a room into a cave, which a cave is very occult-coded, right? Going deeper into the subconscious. And as he goes deeper, he finds that his power animal is a penguin. Okay, keep that in the back of your mind. That'll be important later. In the book, during the scene of this meeting with Chloe talking about porno and banging and stuff, she guides them through this a similar visualization process, but there's more detail. It says, in the book, it says, "Chloe, looking the way she is, I am nothing, not even nothing. Saul, Chloe's shoulder pokes mine when we sit around a circle on the shag carpet. We close our eyes. This was Chloe's turn to guide us in guided meditation, and she talked us into the Garden of Serenity, Chloe talked us up the hill to the Palace of Seven Doors. Inside the palace were the seven doors, the green door, the yellow door, the orange door. And Chloe talked us through opening each door, the blue door, the red door, the white door, and finding what was there. Eyes closed, we imagine our pain as a ball of white healing light, floating around our feet and rising to our knees, our waist, our chest. Our chakras opening, the heart chakra, the head chakra. Chloe talked us into caves where we met our power animal. Mine was a penguin. Ice covered the floor of the cave, and the penguin said, "Slide." Without any effort, we slid through tunnels and galleries. So the question I have, is this about exploring the inner world? Is it about the esoteric over the exoteric, right? It's kind of like how in the occult they talk about the sun, and the sun represents God and all this stuff. Well, in the occult, the esoteric realm is to find God within oneself, within the occult. And you'll notice there's seven doors, seven chakras here. And the goal is to unlock these chakras to allow the energy, the chi, to flow. And this energy is supposed to flow through the body and heal oneself. For Fight Club, it's all about the narrator getting some dang sleep, right? So we have an alchemical process is turning this pain into healing, and the whole guide of the chakras is to do that and facilitate that function. It's a journey the narrator will go on in the film, right? And as will the initiates of Fight Club. And you'll notice the narrator says that he dies and is reborn every evening. He literally in the movie says he's resurrected, okay? And this is all part of the initiation process for the main character. And I'll explain in the conclusion how this is akin to the Freemasonic Hiram Abiff story. Well, in this support group, Marla Singer strolls in. It's a testicular cancer meeting, by the way. And he's seen her at all these meetings, and she's doing the same thing that he's doing. And he's like, well, this sucks, because now I can't cry, and now I can't sleep, because her lie is reflecting his lie. So now he's got insomnia, and it's going on for 4 days. And he said, you know what? During the next hug sesh, I'm going to grab her. I'm going to tell her off. So one night, Chloe's presenting, and she's dying, right? And she's going through this, and she's like, oh, I just want to have sex. It's actually pretty sad. And she starts soliciting for it while she's at the podium. And the group leader's like, okay, all right, all right, all right. And the group leader guides everyone into meditation, same as last time. But this time the narrator goes into the cave, and instead of a penguin being there, it's Marla. Marla has infiltrated his cave. Marla is now finding a place inside of his internal processes. And this is a real problem. So afterwards, he's got, and narrator's got a name tag that says his name is Rupert. And Rupert, you know, narrator, grabs Marla afterwards, calls her a tourist. He's like, I'm on to you. And she says, I saw you practicing this, telling me off. Is it going as good as well as you thought? And the narrator, he's threatening to expose her, right? And she's like, well, I'll expose you. And they bond over their view that when people are dying, they actually get people to listen to them, right? Instead of waiting for their turn to speak, they're actually listening. So they kind of like that element of this whole thing. So they decide they're going to debate who gets to go to these meetings, these support groups. And she ends up leading him into a laundromat. She starts pulling clothes from a dryer, and they're not even hers. And she takes him to a pawn shop. And he's like, what are you doing here? And you know, in the book, they explain it. And the book, I think, is actually Tyler that does this. She's actually just, you know, stealing clothes from a laundromat and selling them, which is like, oh, that's pretty smart. Pretty rotten. It's still theft. It's still illegal. Just something you wouldn't typically think of doing. So, and that's what, like, the whole movie is about. It's like, everyone's real clever, you know? Very Gen X, very clever, very snarky. So they end up debating, and they divvy up the group nights, who gets to go to what thing and when. And the narrator is actually a little sad about it, in a way. And he reluctantly says, you know what, maybe we should exchange numbers if, you know, just in case we ever want to switch nights again. And she asks him what his real name is because he doesn't write it down. She's like, is it Cornelius? Is it Rupert? Is it Travis? Is it any of these stupid names you give every night? And we don't hear anything. But what I hear in my tinfoil hat laden brain, he's got multiple alter egos. Sounds very dissociative identity disorder, right? Roseanne Barr talked about how she had a bunch of alters. So did Nicki Minaj. All these people are Illuminate confirms. And so is the narrator. So the narrator then talks about how he flies around the country for his work, for the dreaded day job. And he says, you know, you can wake up at a different place at a different time. So could you wake up as a different person? And what's funny is that during the scene, you even see Tyler going past narrator at the airport on the walkways. But again, the idea of the alters comes up to mind, right? The alters and, you know, I would argue that flying for narrator is a bit like going over the rainbow, which is a coded term from Eyes Wide Shut, which is a term they use in MKUltra programming and the mind control programming. The victims go over the rainbow. It forces them to dissociate and create an alter in order to survive and deal with the traumatic abuse that is happening to them. So the narrator laments a variety of things, single-serving shampoos, soaps, individually wrapped Q-tips. I also agree. My environmentalist inside of me hates all that stuff. You know, it's like, man, we're going to have this plastic go to a landfill forever? Forever? For like two shots of shampoo? That's crazy. Anyway, he's unwrapping a single-serve mint in a hotel room. He's watching TV. They show a serving staff on that, you know, like Channel 1, the channel that shows you all the crap going on at the resort or whatever. And there's a serving staff, and they're like, welcome, you know. And if you look on the far right, you can see Tyler is in this thing, right? So Tyler's entering his subconscious as well. He talks about the dreaded day job. He's a recall coordinator for a large car company, and he applies a formula that determines if it's worth for the corporation to do a recall or to simply let the people get into accidents and die, and then they can pay off the families. Like, whatever's cheaper is the one they do, which makes sense, right? Makes sense in the idea that, like, that's what happens in America. Of course it does. And he's explaining all this to a person on the plane who's sitting next to him while he's simultaneously fantasizing about a mid-air plane collision. And in part two, in the conclusion, we're going to talk more about this idea of 9/11 predictive programming, because there's a ton of it in this movie, right? Because, again, released in October 99, you know, just 2 years shy of 9/11. So narrator wakes up on the airplane after this fantasy of a mid-air collision. And now he's seated next to Tyler Durden on the plane. And this is right after he got done saying, what if you wake up as a different person? Take a listen.
If you are seated in an emergency exit row, yeah, and feel you would be unable or unwilling to perform the duties listed on the safety card, please ask a flight attendant to reseat you.
It's a lot of responsibility.
Want to switch seats?
No, I'm not sure I'm the man for that particular job.
An exit door procedure at 30,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
The illusion of safety.
Yeah, I guess so.
You know why they put oxygen masks on planes?
So you can breathe.
Oxygen gets you high. In a catastrophic emergency, you're taking giant panic breaths. Suddenly you become euphoric, docile. You accept your fate. It's all right here. Emergency water landing, 600 miles an hour. Blank faces, calm as Hindu cows.
That's an interesting theory. What do you do?
What do you mean?
What do you do for a living?
Why? So you can pretend like you're interested.
Okay.
You have a kind of sick desperation in your laugh.
We have the exact same briefcase.
Soap.
Sorry?
I make and I sell soap. The yardstick of civilization.
And this is how I met
Tyler Durden.
Did Do you know if you mixed equal parts of gasoline and frozen orange juice concentrate, you can make napalm?
No, I did not know that. Is that true?
That's right. One can make all kinds of explosives using simple household items.
Really?
If one were so inclined.
Tell, you are by far the most interesting single-serving friend I've ever met. See, I have this thing, everything on a plane is single-serving, even the...
Well, I get it. It's very clever.
Oh, thank you.
How's that working out for you?
What?
Being clever.
Great.
Keep it up, then. Right up. Now a question of etiquette. As I pass, do I give you the ass or the crotch?
So Tyler is the, you know, he's snarky like every other character, you know, very Gen X. And they discuss the emergency exit plans and how it's, you know, it's just the illusion of safety, a term I love to use. You know, I'm also a snarky Gen Xer. And he says that, you know, the oxygen masks are there to make you docile and accept your fate of death. And you can see it on the faces of the hand. Now everyone's calm as Hindu cows. The point here, zoom out, and you can see it on the faces of narrator and Tyler. Tyler is this sort of ultra confident, very sexy alpha male type, the all-knowing alpha male. He's mansplaining to narrator. Narrator's used to mansplaining, but here comes a guy with even more confidence who knows even more, right? He's everything that narrator wishes he could be. Did narrator wake up to this new man? What is this, right? And we also hear Tyler explain to narrator how he makes and sells soap. And even notes, he's like, oh, we've got this same exact briefcase. That's kind of crazy. And you'll hear Tyler say he calls the soap the yardstick of civilization. Well, why does he say that? Well, this comes from Sigmund Freud, Bernays' uncle, who said that he talked about this exact thing in the Civilization and Its Discontents essay from the 1930s. Where he was saying that the widespread use of soap was showing society's obsession for hygiene. And that means that ultimately people were persuaded through social pressures to repress their inner instincts and their inner shadow. Specifically in the writing, he says this: dirtiness of any kind seems to us incompatible with civilization. We extend our demand for cleanliness to the human body, too. We are astonished to learn of the objectionable smell which emanated from Roy Soleil. That's actually, I had to look that up. Didn't know what that meant. That's King Louis the 16th. Okay? Because back in the day, they stank. I always make jokes with me and Josie on Breaking Social Norms. I always talk about this idea of like all these like old-timey 16th century shows are always like super horny. They're always banging it out. And I always think, how did they do that? I bet it smelled so awful. Like they didn't have the same cleanliness standards back then. And that's what my man Freud is saying. He's like, bro, King Louis the 16th, that guy stank. And he says, when we shake our heads on the Isola Bella, which is an island in Italy, when we are shown the tiny wash basin in which Napoleon made his morning toilet. Indeed, we are not surprised by the idea of setting up of the actual use of soap as an actual yardstick of civilization. The same is true of order. It, like cleanliness, applies solely to the works of man. But whereas cleanliness is not to be expected in nature, order, on the contrary, has been imitated from her. Now, what Freud is saying is that nature is dirty, it's messy, yet there is some level of order because you can observe that. You can see that there's seasons, there's days, there's nights, and so on. There is a sort of pattern. So humans, we try to emulate the example of nature by instilling some sense of order in our lives, which is the soap. And that's what this whole movie is about. It's about mayhem and chaos versus order, consumerism, society, social norms. And of course, we're talking order out of chaos because the world is very chaotic. It's the Freemasonic phrase for the 33rd degree, which we're going to unpack the Freemason symbolism at the end of part two. But in the movie, our narrator is going through chaotic processes and chaos. And in the end, there will be some kind of new planned order. This is the New World Order, specifically given to us through 9/11, which this very movie is predictively programming into us. All right? You got to stick with me. So go while I'm talking, your mission, go subscribe. If you're on YouTube watching this, if this made it to YouTube, hit the subscribe button. If you're on Rumble, hit the subscribe button. If you're on Spotify, Apple, whatever you're consuming this on, subscribe so you don't miss part two. Okay? All right. Now, this scene also gives another one of my favorite lines I use, I mean, at least once a week. How's that working out for you? You know, being clever. I love it. I just, you know, this movie captures my Gen X snarkiness very well. Then Tyler says, as I passed, do I give you the ass or the crotch? And he gives narrator the ass. And then he walks past a stewardess and he clearly gives her the crotch. He even looks down. He's a real perv. Okay. Now, when they get off the plane, they part ways. Narrator, his suitcase gets pulled aside because it's vibrating because the throwers, they pull it off the line. And narrator goes to the airport worker and he's like, what's going on? Where's my suitcase? And he says, well, most of the time they pull it because it's vibrating. And he's like, excuse me, it's vibrating? And the worker says, yeah, most of the time it's a dildo. Correction, a dildo doesn't vibrate. A vibrator vibrates, but a dildo does not, just for people who weren't aware of that. So, like, I will meet the Gen X snarkiness with more Gen X superior snarkiness. A dildo does not vibrate. All right. Which is ironic because the whole film is about like clever quips and you know what I'm saying. So the narrator, he takes a taxi cab to his apartment and finds out it's been blown to bits. All of his goods, all of his furniture strewn across the sidewalk. And he alludes to, he's like, well, maybe the pilot light went out and the condo got filled with gas from the stove. And the refrigerator compressor kicked on and sparked up the whole place, right? So narrator's got no place to stay. So he calls Marla and he hangs up. Then he calls Tyler. So this is the path narrator chooses to take. It's either the divine feminine, the Sophia, which is represented by Marla, or the masculine, the shadow of Tyler. Now in this scene, you're going to notice, and I'm going to put these images up on the Instagram, at Isaac Weishaupt, if you're on the audio status, if you're watching the video version, I will, of course, put it on the screen. Isn't that lovely? This service I provide with a video version, my goodness. You'll notice that on the business card, so Tyler, while he was on the plane talking about his soap business, he hands him a business card, all right? And this is very strange, because on the back of the business card, you can see someone handwritten the number 555-0178. What is that about? I have no idea. Because the front of the card, which the camera also clearly shows, Tyler's number is 555-0153. And the camera even zooms in on him dialing at a payphone. And for the young people, the way it used to work back in the 90s, there were these phones just in random places. And you would have to have a quarter and you would chuck it into this phone and you would call people. The bummer was if the answer machine picked up, you lost your quarter. If it was still ringing, you could stop the phone and get your quarterback and try a different number. Oh, it was a simple time. An annoying but simple time. But when he's dialing the number on the payphone, the camera even zooms in. You can see him dial. I mean, you see the 50153. So we know he called the number on the front of the card. And to add confusion, later on, while he's living with Tyler, there's a rotary phone on the wall, and it shows you what the phone number to the house is, and it's neither of those numbers. The house number that it shows on the rotary phone says 288-555-8771. What is up with these numbers? It could just be incontinuities. Something else you see in the scene is that Marla's phone number is 555-0134. Something interesting here. The reason he finds this number, because he hasn't seen Marla in a couple weeks, right? And everything in his apartment exploded out the window. Well, this piece of paper that she wrote her number down magically survived this condo explosion. And the narrator picked it up. He found it on the sidewalk. And he picked it up, and it's got her name on it. Just like the magical passports from 9/11, right? You remember that? Massive airliners blowing up with just tons of explosive fuel, enough to bring down two massive skyscrapers that were specifically built for a plane to run into them. Yet and still, they find these passports intact. Isn't that something? Now, fun fact, the number here that Marla has is the same number that we see in Christopher Nolan's first film, Memento, also a great movie, which reminds me again of the Freemasons. They have the phrase Memento Mori, which means to remember that you must die, which is, again, the main idea of this initiation ritual, facing death to be rebirthed, right? And again, I'll explain in the conclusion. Furthermore, we later find out that Marla lives in apartment number 513. So what you see is these common numbers over and over, from the phone number to the apartment. 1, 3, and 5 are the numbers that keep recurring. Well, what does this mean? Pythagoras, the first secret society cult leader of all time, was obsessed with numerology. He thought that God spoke in numbers, which is something you kind of pick up from mathematics when you study that. And what's the possible connection here? I guess if you had to look at it, could be that 1 represents the monad or the all or God. This is a very, perennial philosophy. It's this idea of like a global consciousness idea. We're all connected as God, woo-woo stuff. 3 is the number for manifestation. It's the triangle of manifestation, the pyramid, and so on. 5 is the number of the pentagram. This is the human experience of the material realm with, you know, this is a Pythagorean sacred sequence would take you down these odd numbers. And the pentagram was also what you saw as the number chosen for Pythagoras' cult. In fact, you could see this in a Disney video clip. They show the people in their hands, they have the pentagram on it. And if you keep going from 1, 3, 5, you've got 7, which is the 7 chakras, which we talked about on the support group scene earlier. And to go further, you've got the number 9, which is the end of the cycle before starting back at number 1. And you're talking about in a base 10 system, because you go 0 through 9, and then you put a 1 in the front, and then you go 0 through 9, then you put a 2 in the front, you know, you got what I'm saying. So 9 is the final stage of completion before the rebirth. It's where the number dies and is reborn differently at number 10. If you go even further past 9, though, you got the number 11, which is the number of magic, which is described as the accursed number because it is outside the 10, the number of completion in Kabbalah. And Kenneth Grant said that the number 11 represents the evil side of the dark side of the tree of life, the Klepoth, kind of like the number 66. Also listed on the card, you got more 5s and 3s and 7s, because Tyler Durden apparently lives at 537 Paper Street. And if you're curious about the location of where this film is, there's no specific location believed to be the actual city. On the business cards, it says it's in Bradford, and the zip code is 19808. And if you look up that zip code, it's actually Wilmington, Delaware. So if you are forced to pick a location, it's in Delaware. Also, take note that the front of the business card shows two twin cherubs, staring at each other. This, I believe, is narrator and Tyler, his shadow. Now, earlier he exchanged numbers with Marla, and, you know, she wrote her number down on his hand, which he later apparently wrote on a piece of paper. So anyways, my point is he calls Marla, ends up hanging up before she picks up. He changes his mind. He wants to pursue the shadow, Tyler. Calls Tyler. Tyler doesn't answer either, but he calls back after star 69ing, which, for my young folks out there, what happened is back in the day, someone would call you and you didn't have to answer. If you paid for the star 69 service, it would call them back. So what happens is Tyler picks up and they agree to meet up at a bar at Lou's Tavern, where narrator is lamenting about how he just lost everything, you know, all the perfectly chosen clothes and all this perfect furniture that defines him as a person. All of it's gone. And Tyler, he understands. Take a listen.
I don't know. It's just when you buy furniture, you tell yourself, that's it. That's the last sofa I'm going to need. Whatever else happens, I've got that sofa problem handled. I had it all. I had a stereo that was very decent. A wardrobe that was getting very respectable. I was close to being complete.
Shit, man, now it's all gone.
All gone.
All gone. Do you know what a duvet is?
Comfort.
It's a blanket. Just a blanket. Now, why do guys like you and I know what a duvet is? Is this essential to our survival? In the hunter-gatherer sense of the word? No. What are we then?
Consumers.
Right. We are consumers. We are byproducts of a lifestyle obsession. Murder, crime, poverty, these things don't concern me. What concerns me are celebrity magazines, television with 500 channels, some guy's name on my underwear. Rogaine, Viagra, Olestra.
Martha Stewart.
Fuck Martha Stewart. Martha's polishing the brass on the Titanic. It's all going down, man. So fuck off with your sofa units and string green stripe patterns. I say never be complete. I say stop being perfect. I say let's evolve. Let the chips fall where they may. That's me, and I could be wrong. Maybe it's a terrible tragedy.
It's just stuff. It's not tragedy.
Well, you did lose a lot of versatile solutions for modern living.
Fuck, you're right. No, that's me. My insurance is probably going to cover it, so. What?
Things you own end up owning you. But do what you like, man.
Tyler understands, because he knows what a duvet is, even though it's not essential to surviving as a man in the hunter-gatherer sense. I know what a duvet is. I've got a couple of them. What does that say about me? Maybe I'm an awful consumer too. A little beta male cuck. They're just consumers. And consumers are always trying to achieve the state of perfection that's defined by the corporations, by ads and marketing. And this is commentary on the state of men and modern society. And it's basically blaming the free market capitalism for making us pursue what a quote unquote real man is, through buying products instead of what actually is the qualities of a quote-unquote real man. Tyler says, look, we need to change our mindset. We need to give up on this idea, this status we can never reach, this level of perfection. Let the chips fall where they may. Chaos. And he drops the iconic line that I think about at least once a day. Things you own end up owning you. I mean, truer words were never spoken. That's the truth. That's what I admire about some of like the hippies and the off-grid folks. I could never do that. But I'm like, I respect that. I respect that hustle. To just disconnect from the world and be like, I'm not doing none of this BS. I mean, I don't know if I could do it. I like air conditioning. I like ice in my water. I like me a Sam's Cola Zero, you know? So they go outside, and the narrator asks if he can stay the night after Tyler forces him to be a man, be direct. Ask me directly. You know, he's teaching Tyler, the shadow, is teaching narrator how to be a real man because he's a beta soy cuck, all right? He then forces narrator to punch him. He says, look, I've never been in a fight. You? How can you know who you are without being in a fight? And this is a reference to know thyself. Again, part of the initiation process. This movie is basically a modern-day Eleusinian mystery school. So narrator agrees, reluctantly, and he punches him in the ear, no less, and they start fighting. Now, in the book, during this first fight between Tyler and the narrator, the book describes basically what this whole movie's about. It's all about self-destruction, annihilation of self. I'm going to read you from the book. I didn't want to, but Tyler explained it all about not wanting to die without any scars, about being tired of watching only professionals fight, and wanting to know more about himself. That's the know thyself, right? About self-destruction. At the time, my life just seemed too complete, and maybe we have to break everything to make something better out of ourselves. So this is very much trying to strip down to the basic, down to getting rid of the ego. This is the beginning of the journey. This is the know thyself, where the initiates, a term that goes all the way back to ancient Greece, they inscribed know thyself at the temple of Apollo at Delphi. It's about unpacking what's going on inside of ourselves in order to find and integrate the shadow, which is Tyler, right? Plot spoiler. And at this point, narrator breaks the fourth wall, and he shifts gears a little bit. Explains how Tyler actually has all these little part-time jobs. He's a projectionist who splices porno scenes into family films. When the cigarette burns, cue him to change the reel. Tyler's also a server at the Pressman Hotel, where he pisses in the soup and farts in the meringue and jacks off in the soup. And in the movie, he's of course talking about all these jobs Tyler has, but in the book, there's a scene in one of the jobs where Tyler explains how unimportant jobs really are. This is what it says in the book. Tyler says, "So tell the banquet manager, get me fired. I'm not married to this chicken shit job." Everybody looks at their feet. Getting fired, Tyler says, is the best thing that could happen to any of us. That way we'd quit treading water and do something with our lives. And this is all about rejecting capitalism, rejecting what the social norms tell us to be, tell us to do, right? Going to the office, begging for a raise, doing what you're told. Like, these are all weak beta soy cuck things. Tyler is the shadow. He is the alpha red pill manosphere guy. And he's like, you got to reject all this. But the problem is like, women are also groomed into this system too. What, I'm going to tell my wife, hey, I'm going to quit working. I just decided I don't want to do this anymore. Shoot, that clock is ticking. She's about out the door. You know what I'm saying? And I don't blame her. Like, that's the way society it leads us to try to find this security through financial independence. So they get to Tyler's house. It's a shacked up place. It's, you know, he's squatting in it. It's falling apart. And the symbolism of going into a home is the same as going deeper into the subconscious of a main character. It's, you know, because the house is a shithole, nothing works, it's dilapidated, it's falling apart. It's a void of all the commercial IKEA capitalist trappings, right? And in this is where the narrator's shadow, the subconscious mind, resides. No frills, no bills, no problems. Just a couple of dudes, they're fighting, they're drinking beers, they're hitting golf balls. And Tyler and narrator, they're reading articles. You know, I am Jack's colon. I am Jill's nipple. So anyways, the narrator goes back to work, and he says now that he's fighting, it's turned down the volume on life. He can deal with anything now. This is the meditative flow state for him. You can achieve this through a variety of different forms, CrossFit, meditation, prayer, you know, whatever you want to, however you want to do this. Well, for him, this is how he does it. So they talk about being a generation raised by women, and if getting married is what they should actually do, is that actually going to be the fix? And it, like, for me, when I hear this, I think about like incels, and I think, is this where the sort of alpha male red pill type stuff comes from, right? So the natural progression of this, of course, is that Tyler and narrator take their alpha pill manosphere stuff and they create Fight Club. It's a place where men can meet up and achieve the same flow state of enlightenment through fighting. And here's where we get the rules of Fight Club. The first one, of course, you do not talk about Fight Club. And in the movie, they show the fights. And during the scenes, of course, all the men are very alive and vibrant in there, unleashing their true inner warrior, and they're very happy. even if it means they're getting their faces smashed in. They're very much selling this as something that all men should aspire to, right? They even compare it to a church. And they say, in the quote of what they actually say is, afterward, we all felt saved, all right? It's a very much a religious experience. It's a transcendence. It's a state of enlightenment, of bliss, okay? We also hear that Fight Club is only real during the hours at which Fight Club takes place. And the whole idea is that the fighting changes their perspective of the whole world and gives them purpose. And they say stuff like they feel sorry for men packed into gyms, like CrossFit, trying to look like what Calvin Klein wants them to look like, you know, like these models, which is very priceless and ironic coming from Brad Pitt, who in the very next scene is shredded up with the oily abs that we all aspire to. So that's where the Fight Club gets birthed. And from here, Marla, she calls Tyler's house and narrator picks up the phone and she's like, where you been? It's been 8 weeks. I haven't seen you. And asking why he hasn't been going to the support groups. Well, he's got a new thing. It's Fight Club. Unfortunately, he can't talk about it because, you know, see the first rule of Fight Club. She's like, well, okay, I took a full bottle of Xanax and I'm going to die. And basically sort of coerces him into saving her. So he goes over there, brings her back to the house. He's dropping pipe to keep her awake because she can't fall asleep, you know, because she's going to die. But what's weird is that he wakes up and Marla is actually in the room with Tyler. And he thought, oh, was this a dream? Apparently, she's been, you know, getting it in with Tyler. So it becomes this recurring thing after this point where Marla will come over and she has sex with Tyler, which bugs narrator because he hates Marla so much. It's like another area of his life where she has now infiltrated. In the book, it's actually much more nihilistic than in the film, in the scene. I'm going to read you from the book. It says, you give up all your worldly possessions and your car and go live in a rented house in the toxic waste part of town where late at night you can hear Marla and Tyler in his room calling each other human butt wipe. Take it, human butt wipe. Do it, butt wipe. Choke it down. Keep it down, baby. And another side note, in the movie, you'll notice that whenever narrator gets out of a cab, it says very clearly on the side, it says scat, which is, of course, another term for doo-doo, right? And then you also hear Tyler talk about we are the, you know, singing, dancing crap of the world. So it's a very nihilistic idea. It's almost satanic. It's this idea of putting down humans as just, you know, being pieces of shit, which is in the book as well. So Tyler, he's at work and he talks about how they, or I'm sorry, narrator, he's at work and he's talking about how the people he works with, his supervisor, they all hate that he's fighting because he shows up bruised and bloody and all this stuff. And his response is to say, I am enlightened. Okay. So he straight up tells you all these things like throughout the movie, if you know what you're looking for. Oh, Tyler at this point confirms that the narrator blew up his own condo as an effort to reject materialism and his perceptions are now realigned. He is now enlightened. Tyler talks about the process for making soap and how the best fat comes from humans. So what they do is they go to a liposuction clinic and they go dumpster diving and they take it home. And, you know, at this point, Tyler is talking about how you can use glycerin from soap, from the process of making soap, to make dynamite. And then there's talk about human sacrifices, or how the idea of lye came about. And that's how civilizations learned what soap was, from all the human sacrifices. And this is a recurring theme in the movie, this idea of human sacrifice. And the whole purpose of him talking about it is because there's this idea that we need death or annihilation or total destruction in order for there to be a perfected rebirth, both on a personal level and a social level. And the book talks a lot about this whole idea, and it talks about the idea of creating homemade explosives in the book a bunch, like the Anarchist Cookbook almost. It says, from the book, it says, the building we're standing on won't be here in 10 minutes. You take a 98% concentration of fuming nitric acid and add the acid to three times that amount of sulfuric acid. Do this in an ice bath. Also very ironic and predictive programming of later Red Pill Manosphere stuff, because they're always talking about the ice bath, right? Then add glycerin drop by drop with an eyedropper. You have nitroglycerin. I know this because Tyler knows this. Mix the nitro with sawdust and you have a nice plastic explosive. A lot of folks mix their nitro with cotton and add Epsom salts as a sulfate. This works too. Now, all of this is actually true. I looked it up. Alfred Nobel was the one that figured out how to make dynamite, mixing nitroglycerin with sawdust to make it a solid. And the reason there are, and a lot of people bring up the irony that the guy who invented dynamite has the Peace Prize named after him, the Nobel Peace Prize. And that's because Alfred Nobel, he donated his fortune to this Nobel Foundation, which was funded to give prizes to people who benefit mankind the most. So that's how the Peace Prize came about from this, you know, this dynamite thing. In the book, when Tyler is teaching him how to make soap, he describes the process that he's subjugating him to. Listen to this. In the book, it says, Tyler says, I'm nowhere near hitting the bottom yet. And if I don't fall all the way, I can't be saved. Jesus did it with his crucifixion thing. I shouldn't just abandon money and property and knowledge. This isn't just a weekend retreat. I should run from self-improvement, and I should be running towards disaster. I can't just play it safe anymore. This isn't a seminar. If you lose your nerve before you hit the bottom, Tyler says, you'll never really succeed. Only after disaster can we be resurrected. It's only after you've lost everything that you're free to do anything. What I'm feeling is premature enlightenment. And keep stirring, Tyler says. When the fat's boiled enough that no more tallow rises, throw out the boiling water, wash the pot, and fill it with clean water. I ask, am I anywhere near hitting bottom? Where you're at now, Tyler says, you can't even imagine what the bottom will be like. And this is all very interesting. I hear elements of like the 9/11 thing of, you know, the rebuilding idea and like destruction needed before you could rebuild into perfection. I hear a lot of ideas of the occult process of crossing the abyss through destruction of the ego. You know, the abyss, of course, being the bottom here that Tyler is talking about. It sounds very comparable to me. They even compare it to Christ's journey of death and resurrection. And that's going to round out the part one of this episode now, or of this series, I should say. Like I said before, subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening right now. YouTube, Spotify, you know, wherever. Apple. Because I'm going to come back with part two where we're going to pick up where we left off. And we're going to unpack the rest of this movie. And then I'm going to put it all together in the conclusion where we are going to understand fully how this is an initiation ritual, how this is part of the whole idea of the predictive programming of 9/11, right? The destruction to bring down the twin pillars and rebuild it as the one singular pillar. It's very Kabbalistic when you look at it through that sense and through that lens. And it's amazing that this story, that I haven't picked up on this story before, the whole Fight Club, I've seen it so many times, but when I sat down and watched it through this occult symbolism lens, I said, this is a mass ritual. This is a mass initiation. And that's where we go with the film, with Project Mayhem. Project Mayhem is about trying to initiate the entire world through the destruction and rebuilding process, okay? It's very Freemasonic. It's very, like I talked about with Jesus and the resurrection thing that's spelled out in the book, it's very much what we're looking at is this Hiram Abiff Freemasonic initiation ritual. So, stay tuned, stay subscribed to the show for part two because it's going to get real juicy, okay? Also, if you want to support the show, leave a 5-star review wherever you're at. That helps me a ton. I do a lot of work on my end, and it's tragic and unfortunate that I get a lot of people who want to leave 1-star reviews because they don't get it, or they think I'm lying, or they think I'm making this up, or that I'm just a crazy conspiracy guy. So if you want to support the show, you want to, you know, hook me up, give me a 5-star review. Wherever you're at, it's fine. If you're already on Patreon and you're like, hey, where do I do it? Don't even worry about it. You're good. You're already on Patreon, you're good. There's no 5-star for Patreon. But Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, whatever. Leave a 5-star review because that helps me more than you can imagine. It takes you a second and it helps me a ton. It helps counteract the 1-star haters because they're out there hating. So thank you for listening. Thank you for your time. And until next time, stay positive.